Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Rising costs of living are forcing skilled workers towards poverty. So what can you do to support professionals struggling to put food on the table? On today's episode of All About Business, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Mark Gain, co-founder of The Bread and Butter Thing, a wonderful organization that has given themselves the mission to unleash the power of food and ignite long-lasting change in struggling neighborhoods across the UK. The Bread and Butter Thing also helps people upskill to make sustainable long-term changes to their situations. Today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Mark Gain to our studio. Mark has come from Manchester today, and he is the founder and the CEO of The Bread and Butter Thing, an award-winning charity that helps make life more affordable for people by redistributing surplus food through community-led food clubs. This is a subject that I'm really interested, Mark, in learning more about. You know, what is the situation? Why are you doing this? And also your own journey to become a leader of a charity that obviously is doing really important work. I understand that you supply 250,000 meals a week to people, principally in the north of England. What is the issue here? What is going on in the UK that has made this charity such an important provider of support for people? What's happening?
The stark truth is that wages don't pay as much as they did. Things are cost a hell of a lot more than they used to. And working families that are doing all the right things that government and society would want of them still can't make things stretch. So we have best part of 15 million people in poverty, but poverty is a really difficult thing to wrap your head around because it's not just a physical manifestation, it's emotional as well. And when you have people that they're doing 50-hour weeks. So I do a podcast, as you know, James, and I meet a lot of our members that we support, and I see working families all the time. Last week, I met a data analyst for the Ministry of Justice. His wife is a full-time payroll clerk, and they use Bread and Butter because at the end of last year, they came out of a fixed-term mortgage and their mortgage quadrupled overnight.
I see. So this is because interest rates have gone up.
Interest rates have gone up.
Suddenly they've got to pay a lot more.
Absolutely. So
Quadrupled. So that's tipped them into what you would call poverty.
What would you call poverty? Because between them...
Well, I'm not sure. That's what I want to understand. You said 15 million people category.
Kind of defined by kind of looking at 60% of the kind of average salaries sort of thing. But I see poverty differently. I think poverty in itself is... You take David that I just mentioned to you. He's not looking at an average salary. He's a data analyst and his wife's a professional as well.
So I know what data analysts are, and it's quite a lot.
Yeah. So
it's his outgoings that have caused
it. It's his outgoings that have crippled him. Yeah. So would you say he's in poverty? Well, he wouldn't be a government statistic, but is he struggling to get by? Bloody hell yeah.
Right. Your principal customers or audience, what do you call the people who participate?
Members.
Members.
We call them our members. Yeah. A bit like co-op.
Right. So your members, they're typically people with jobs.
Yeah, so half of our members are working families. Yeah, absolutely. The other half, yes, there will be people on benefits or there will be retired people or people with disabilities.
Right. So let's start with the people in jobs. So this sort of in-work poverty mm-hmm. phenomenon, you said work doesn't pay as it used to. It was the sort of implication. When did this start becoming apparent to you and what are the causes of it?
I think it started really to become apparent to us probably a year or so before COVID.
Right.
So just before COVID, prices were putting the pressure on. Obviously, austerity had come in with 2008, and that was hitting a lot of things. You were starting to see cutbacks in public sector. We were seeing a lot of people being made redundant and thousands of people from the public sector losing their jobs, right? But
But actually, jobs went up during the coalition. I have to say that.
Which is fascinating.
Because I was there, and I remember there were more vacancies, and more people ended up employed at the end of the coalition than at the beginning.
And that's really interesting, because that could be a separate podcast in itself, couldn't it?
Well, there's something's going on here, though, that's different from just unemployment, which is awful, I agree.
It is. And it's looking at the inflation costs, et cetera. The really interesting graph where you can see from the 80s, to 2025, where you can actually see the graph of the salaries, the average salaries going up and up and up, and they kind of plateau in the noughties.
Yeah, real wages stopped rising.
Real wages did stop rising.
And that's the productivity of people stopped rising.
CPI and RPI didn't stop rising.
Prices?
Yes.
You mean, yeah. So wages stop? Well, that's why real wages didn't keep going, because prices kept going faster. That's the conundrum here.
That is absolutely the challenge. When you start to look at the cost of product, the cost of living going up and up, but your wages don't, that has to be acknowledged. And I don't think it is sufficiently. I don't think there's enough support that is out there to help working families.
So one of the reasons I was keen to talk to you, Mark, is that I'm concerned that this is going to become a bigger issue with new technologies potentially consuming jobs and more people finding themselves in this difficult situation.
Yeah.
So is that a worry of yours? Do you feel that the demand for your service is going to get, how are you going to fulfill it? How are we going to prepare for this? What do we do as a society and as an organization?
I think it's really interesting, James, that I would say from my perspective and what I see every day, that we're already in a problem, because whether they lose their jobs or not, people can't afford to get by. I would say there's a vast majority of people already in low-paid work, gig economy type stuff that frankly isn't meeting the day-to-day needs. So we already have people that need support that are working. And I don't know where the kind of AI revolution is going to go and whether we're going to look at universal basic income, et cetera, but that's going to cost billions that nobody wants to pay either.
No, I think that's the rub of it. I mean, that seems to be the problem.
I agree. But at the same time, the dichotomy that we see is you have citizens of the UK doing everything that is expected of them, and yet they cannot afford to get by. And the help that government gives them, I don't think there's any way of kind of dressing this up. I think it's hidden. So if you think about a working family, the person that goes to work, they don't engage with the benefits system. So where do they find the information about what is available for them for free dentistry or free optometry, et cetera? There is no marketing out there. There is no central resource for them to find this help and support. So we say hidden help isn't help. It's just not there. And there are billions, literally over 20 billion every year of unclaimed benefits that should be out there.
Really?
Yeah.
That seems to me that could be solved by some sort of very well-designed hub, digital hub or resource.
Yeah.
But that's not there at the moment.
That's not there.
Right.
Now, I'm sure that the people listening, there will be people screaming, oh, well, there's citizens' advice. There is. But they are completely oversubscribed and really struggling to do the great job they do already. Yes. It's not enough.
If, like me, you run a business or manage a team, you'll know how important it is to hire great people. Over the last 65 years, Reed has worked with thousands of businesses around the world, helping them to recruit and to grow. This is what inspired us to create Reed.ai, your new AI hiring agent. It's here to save you money, to save you time, and to help you get the right match. Whether you're hiring your first team member or your 50th, Reed AI is here to make it easier. Try it free for 28 days, exclusively available during our beta period. Go to Reed.ai and get started. Reed.ai, your higher power. You founded the bread and butter thing.
I did, yeah.
In 2015, as I understand. Yep. What motivated you to do that at that particular time? And I have to ask, because I'm always intrigued by this, why did you call it the bread and butter thing?
Ah, right. Okay. So my other half, Jane, started this with me. I guess you could say she's the brains in the back of house and I'm the front of house.
Right.
And so where does the bread and butter thing come from? Bread and butter is your everyday essentials. So my dad always used to say that's the bread and butter of things. And why is it a thing? I call it a thing because I saw it as a movement, put it in a sentence. It's becoming a thing. the bread and butter thing is becoming a thing. So it's more of a conceptual thing to become a movement recognizing the need for such provisions.
Okay.
Complicated, I know. But
your dad used to say this.
Yeah, he used to say it's the bread and butter. That's my bread and butter. That's what I do every day. That's my bread and butter.
Right. So that's what, so that, and then you work with your wife,
yep,
Jane. How do you divide up responsibilities? Why are you laughing?
That's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah, well, she's not here to ask as well.
Do you know what? We're both accountants by trade.
So you're both accountants. Yeah. Now, this is interesting.
So, but Jane's a far better one than I am.
So, right. So she puts you front of house.
I would say she's more
books,
forensic and more
forensic
compliance.
Accountant.
She's so much more forensic than I would ever be. And I would say I'm more of the corporate financier. So that's the way we roll. But that means right. that I can go out and do the deals, whereas she'll make sure that we're making every.
When you say
count.
Go out and do the deals,
yeah,
what do you mean? I mean, what deals?
Well, grants. We've got to find funding to set up. So we.
Oh, so you're getting grants from donations.
Yeah,
that's the deal. Or do you get food as deals
yeah,
as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're dealing with
yeah.
Well, so talk me through a couple of deals you've done recently.
Okay, so we've had to look at local authorities are a good example.
Yeah,
local authorities. Invite us in to come and open our bread and butter food clubs in their area. When they do, what happens is we will ask them for the first year's costs and the capital cost to set up. So the way we work is we set up a man and a van almost. So
it's, but you ask them to finance the first year's cost?
We do, yeah, because...
You wouldn't have thought of that if you weren't an accountant. I mean, I was inspired. Go on, so then what happens? I'm going to ask this question.
Well, this is a spin, James, because what we do is say, give us your first year funding.
Yeah.
And I know we're a charity, but you'll never have to fund us again. Because right. it's financially sustainable in your area then. Because the costs, the money that we charge our members for their food covers their running costs for that area.
Right. So once it's established.
Yeah, exactly. So we can go into 3 and 5 year deals comfortably on 1 year funding.
Right. So I can see the appeal for the local authority.
Yeah.
So like every good deal, it's good for both parties.
Absolutely.
So how many local authorities have you got signed up?
Wow. It's around 30, I guess.
And if there are any local authorities listening, how do they find you, Mark?
Well,
because I think they should.
I think they should too.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a good thing. So, I mean, it's cost them 1 year to get it set up.
Yep.
And then you can run for 3 or 5 years at no cost to them.
Yeah.
Where'd they find you? What's your URL?
So our easiest one is breadandbutterthing.org. So that's the website. Get in touch by all means.
And you have the capacity to keep growing, do you?
We do. So what we find as, so what's our barrier to growth? It's the food. So it's unlocking more surplus food. So we are the largest B2C food redistribution charity in the UK.
So you said quite a lot in that comment.
I did, didn't
in
I?
In that sense. B2C, explain. Business to consumer.
Business to customer. So we basically take it end to end.
So you're taking it from a supermarket.
We'll take it from a supermarket, a farmer, a manufacturer, and depending on what time of day we pick it up, it could be in the hands of the consumer that day.
And you do that?
We do that.
Right. And you said you're the biggest in the country.
Yep. So we have 140,000 families registered with us. We operate through 145 food clubs across England. So as south as Maidstone and as north as Northumbria.
And how many food suppliers do you have?
Probably about 100.
But and again, you said there were some of them are farmers.
Yeah.
So they were sending potatoes direct or whatever.
Yep. So a lot of outgrades.
So farmers.
Have you ever seen a 2 kilo parsnip?
Maybe. I'm trying to think. Why particularly a 2 kilo?
They're just huge.
Or well, people don't want to buy them, is that?
No, exactly.
You can chop them up and eat
them. They're either too big or too small.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Actually, it doesn't matter. It doesn't
I wish
matter.
I could grow one of them in the garden. I don't think we've achieved that. That would win a prize, wouldn't it? So you get all those off cuts.
Yeah, exactly. We get the outgrades.
They call them outgrades?
Yeah. So they're either too big or too small. Or again, if there are things that are still on the tree, so top fruits like apples, we will do a deal with a farmer. Again, more deals where we'll try and make it cost neutral. So if they carry on picking, so sometimes, particularly post-Brexit, farmers will keep hold of their labourers and they won't always have something to do. So they've got a bit of surplus labour. So then we'll kind of subsidise that and say, we'll pay you a sum towards that labour, but give us the fruit, get them picking again for the kind of class twos or what isn't going to go to your mainstream customers.
Right. So you've got farmers, then you had two other categories.
So manufacturers?
Yeah. So what happens there? What are they giving you?
Let's just say there's a quality rejection from a retailer. So I don't know, there's been a problem with calibrating the labels so it doesn't look pretty, or...
So a whole lot of tins have the labels on wrong.
Or there's salt missing or an ingredient missing out of something. So there's lots of different reasons, but the main one tends to be around forecasting and having food that's not got long enough life left to go on the shelf of a supermarket. Because if you think about it, let's just say for argument's sake, the manufacturer makes it with 7 days life on it. Then it's got to go to a distribution center and it's got to have a minimum shelf life on it to get into a distribution center. And then the distribution center's got to get it to the supermarket itself.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that, but how the hell are you doing this? Because I mean, you've got to do all of that too to get it to your members.
We do, but we're far more agile.
So what do you do? Put it in a van and drop? Yeah, how does it work? How do you make yourself more agile?
So we have three warehouses, but we also partner with a logistics.
Where are they?
So one in Stoke, one in Manchester, one in Durham.
A big shed?
Sorry, four. Four, actually, because there's one in Spalding as well.
Right.
And they're not big sheds. They're about 20,000 square foot, each one of them. And they've got about 15 vans at each one of them. And what we do is get partnered with third-party logistics. They bring the food into us from the manufacturers, farmers, etc. And then we'll look at making from whatever's inbound that day the best possible offer for our members to go out on our vans.
So you create a parcel?
Yeah.
But, is that what you do? Is that how it works? Just to describe to people listening.
Yeah.
So we understand.
So what our offer is to the kind of member, the end user, is three bags of food for $8.50. So a bag of chilled or frozen food.
Three bags of food for $8.50.
Yeah. So a bag of chilled or frozen food, a bag of fruit and veg, and a bag of cupboard goods.
Right.
Typically about 35 to 40 quid worth of food in there.
Right.
So what...
That's dependent on you getting enough of each to come into your warehouse, is it?
That's why we kind of do it that way. Again, accountancy is that portfolio approach, right? So you have enough suppliers, you get enough variety, because each supplier doesn't plan for surplus, because a surplus is a mistake effectively, isn't it?
Sure.
So you have to have enough people going up and down in your supply chain so that you've got an underlying constant feed.
So is that quite labor intensive for you to package them all up like that?
Well, what we do is we put it on the vans and then we go out to the each community project that we partner with to open our food clubs once a week.
Yeah.
And the community come and volunteer.
So that's done locally.
So that's how we keep it. Our cost.
So
down.
Each van has enough in it to do three packages.
And then we get community volunteers to come and help pack the bags.
So if you want to volunteer to work with
you go
to the same place. Say it again.
Breadandbutterthing.org.
Very good. Well, that sounds like a great thing to do. And you said that you got how many of these community centers?
So we've got 145 across the country.
Right.
And
you're trying to grow more, I'm assuming.
So what we're trying
Where was the first one?
Moss Side in Manchester.
Moss Side.
Yeah.
Is that where you lived?
So I was introduced to Michelle and Elaine that ran the food bank there, Compassion Food Bank. And Shebna, who worked in the back, taught me how to pack bags and she was fierce. I had 3 months of training with Shebna and did a lot of thinking in there. And I started.
So you were volunteering then yourself?
Yeah, yeah.
What a great story. And then you thought, I'm going to do this. You've done it slightly differently to a food bank, though, from the sound of what you've
described.
So do you want to make clear what the difference is?
Yeah, so what's the difference? Mainly, well, A, you don't refer to us. Anybody in the community can come along. So we scrutinize the community and the area rather than the individual, because everybody gets a bit tired and bored and fed up of having to demonstrate that they're poor.
Well, to see whether they qualify, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine that's not.
Yeah.
So you just say we're here.
Yeah.
If you want to come, and it's $8.50 for three of these.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's one of those. So if you go back far enough, so I used to run a company called Company Shop, and which did commercial kind of boot rooms, staff shops, selling cheap food to the food industry, and whilst there, kind of developed the first social supermarket in the UK as a subsidiary of it, and.
The first social supermarket. What is that?
So that was means tested. If you're on universal credit,
you had to show something.
Yeah, exactly.
You could come in.
But that just got me thinking, and that showed me how you can go beyond simply calories with such a model. Because everybody talks about food with this, James, but actually there's so much more, because the community piece is huge. the fact that the volunteers come from the community and they feel like they're doing it for themselves gives them a pride. They feel ownership. And the members come along and they all get to know each other. They get to know their community. And then we have service providers that do come along, like Welfare Rights or Public Health or Citizens Advice. And they will also come along and piggyback our service. And that was almost accidental at first, because they just noticed that there was a cluster of people in one place at one time, predictably every week. So they started to shape their services around us. And then we started to recognize that and started to do more curation around it to see what each community needs.
These hubs are open one day a week, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but everyone knows when it is.
Everybody knows when it is. Yeah. And again, it's on the website. We've got like a store
locator. They're all listed on the website.
Yeah, there's a store locator on there. So pop your postcode in and you'll be able to see if we're near you.
The breadandbutterthing.org.
You got it.
Good. No, well, I think it's good that we spread the word.
Indeed.
Big part of my desire to talk to you today, to understand this better and give other people the opportunity to learn about it, because it's a great initiative. So the dignity, people, this word dignity, I heard you use it, and I see and recognize it myself, the importance that work has in giving people dignity and purpose in life.
Yeah,
you've obviously come to that from a different angle in a sense, but because you're sort of looking at it from how you run your community hubs rather than providing jobs. Do you think that's becoming more of an issue in society generally, that it's harder for people to hold on to their dignity?
I think you found the other word that's hard as well, purpose.
Yes.
I think
I'm worried about this.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I'm down in London with you today. We're going to Westminster after this. And there are people in Westminster that say community is lost. And I frankly don't believe that at all.
Well, you don't believe it because you see it in your senses.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're there with the people. And I think people need to get out of Westminster more, frankly.
Could not agree more.
And sit in businesses, sit in organizations like yours, talk to people and see actually what's going on, because, I mean, they don't seem to be particularly well tuned in, do they?
No.
on that issue.
No, they don't.
That being an example.
Yeah. It's a great example. And we see it every day. And that's what we celebrate on our podcast. So
celebrating community.
Yeah. And everyday people.
Yeah.
Just there's some unbelievable people that are doing unbelievable things despite their hardships.
Yeah. Well, that's inspiring, isn't it?
Yeah. And that just, it feels like a privilege to be able to just go and chat to them.
You said to me earlier, and I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, but you had a sort of mischievous youth, or if that's the right word. And then I'm interested because then you became an accountant.
Yeah, yeah.
And now you're running this, I would say, remarkable organization that's bringing people together and doing good work for the community. Can you just tell me a little bit about your own journey? Because I'm intrigued, Mark, and you're laughing. I want to know more. And I think there's a story to be had here, yeah.
Okay, Irish Catholic family, born in Preston on a council estate. Youngest of four lads.
Right.
We were pretty feral as kids.
Right. Did your parents work?
Yeah, dad worked full time back in the day at Danish Bacon.
Right.
So
he was making bacon.
Yeah. And mum didn't work when she got all four of us, because obviously I was the last one around. She wasn't working by that point. But
four brothers, and you were
four brothers.
You were the youngest of four. Yeah. So you must be pretty tough.
I got shouty.
Well, I don't know what your big brothers are like, but you must be pretty resilient.
We had a bit of fun, but yeah. I was saying a bit of a rogue, we did do some stuff, and I did end up with some juvenile convictions, etc. So I was caught joyriding, took a lamppost off a street corner at doing 60.
How old were you when you were doing that?
15.
So 15.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I was lucky. I was very lucky.
You could have killed yourself or other people.
Well, yeah. I was going to say I was lucky I didn't serve time for it.
Right. Well, that too. Well, yeah. So luckily none of those things came to pass.
Exactly. And again, time.
There's a lot of luck involved in life though, isn't there?
But
you look back on that and you
couldn't
think,
agree more, because if you think about it, James, if I'd have done it post 16, I'd have probably had a criminal record that would have affected me and would not have got allowed me to become an accountant and qualify, etc.
So how did you go from joyriding in Preston to becoming an accountant? I mean, that's the next step that I'm interested in. Did your mother say you sort yourself out or did someone else?
No,
or what happened?
It's funny. There was like a little voice in my head, stop screwing around sort of thing. In my early 20s, I think.
One of your personality told you, don't do that anymore. Do something else. What happened?
Get a grip.
That's interesting.
Getting of age, you know.
What age were you then?
Probably 22-ish.
Right.
And
I think a lot of young men grow up in their early 20s.
I think so. Yeah. I do think that there's a truth to that. But I think school wasn't great. Mum and dad weren't educated, so they didn't really understand the value of education either. So they didn't necessarily support. So youngest of four lads going to the same kind of Catholic comp.
Yeah.
As I get through the door, first words from the form teacher, God, not another game.
All right.
it just didn't go well.
That's not fair, is it? I mean, reputation's been made by your older brothers. That's not fair, is it? I mean, but anyway, okay. But your name is good for, oh God, not another game. That makes it a good quote. That's not a good start.
So
it
didn't help really, did it?
No, it didn't.
So I came out of school with very few O levels.
How many have I might ask?
Four.
Four.
One of them was a C.
Right.
So I think the only thing I like is the fact that I did, I actually got a B in physics O level without studying whatsoever.
That's good.
I just liked physics.
Did you get an O level in mathematics?
I did.
So that helps for the accounting.
And then I went on to get an A in A level maths at night school and then realized that I like maths and I like understanding numbers and started to think.
So you went
about
to night school after you left school. So this is that further education. So this is really important. So this voice prompted you, what, 22 to do?
Yeah, Because I went out to get a job at 16 and just spend money, burn money, go and enjoy life.
And that's what you did.
And that's what I did. And yeah.
So what age did you go to night school?
It's that little guy at 22 or whatever. Come on, it's time. And then
what sort of jobs were you doing between 16 and 22?
So dad had a business. Dad had a frozen food business.
So that's interesting. There's a connection there.
Yeah. It's a difficult one because he actually had two businesses and they both failed. And you can look at it and wonder whether or not that's something that drove me to accountancy as well, because I could actually see what was happening in there.
Right.
But you can also look at market conditions, because he was definitely in the 80s when the supermarkets were really coming into their own and the high street stores were somewhat oppressed by them. And that change in market, he didn't adapt to.
Right.
And I think that's what
caused
it. It's
hard to see, though.
It's hard to watch. Yeah, it is. Because he suffered with that. And he had a lot of kind of stress and heart conditions in and out of hospital during that time. So it's a tough watch. But so that's kind of where I was. But frankly, took the mickey when I was working for him, because I could.
Right. He didn't fire you, though.
No, he should have.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. You got a nice dad.
Yeah.
So then you did the accounting.
Yeah.
And
so what I did with the accounting, I went on to the ACCA route. And because I was like over 22 at this time, they had a mature student route. So I took that, but then got a job with an accountancy firm when I'd done the foundation stage of ACCA, recognized how far I was behind others. So decided I was just going to do them every 6 months. So it suddenly became very driven.
Right.
I went, right, I'm going to leapfrog some of these people that are younger than me that are doing the same exams, because actually I need to play catch up now.
Right. So, and you managed to do that.
Yeah.
And then what did you do when you qualified?
So qualified, did a bit of audit, did a bit of corporate finance.
Was this still in Preston? Lancashire?
Yeah, Lancashire.
Yeah.
And then started to do business planning. So I found that one of the partners where I was working was doing consultancy for helping people to develop their SMEs in a preparation for exit, sale, float, whatever. And I found I was really quite capable at that and started to help develop management teams for exits. and sales. And then went on from there to do it with a couple of others. We set up our own practice. And one of my first clients... Building management teams, grooming businesses for sales.
This is an unexpected turn of events, but I want to ask you, what's the couple of key things you want to do to build a management team if you want to sell a business? Because this is an added bonus for
business. Yeah, well, I guess for me, the key thing that we always talked about is making sure that the management know which buttons to press to actually deliver. Because so many teams say we need a budget, and the budget just means numbers. And a budget to me always means you need an operational Gantt chart to go with it. What are going to be the triggers to actually make that happen when you say it's going to happen? And I don't know why, but so many times that's a blind spot. It's like, we're not reaching budget. Well, explain why. Oh, well, we haven't thought about this, this, and this.
Yes.
And the operations and actions that need to go with it don't seem to get documented as they ought. Everyone thinks, oh, well, if we just kind of do that and we go 3% or whatever, and we put a marketing plan behind
that's
it.
That's not very useful.
No, it's got to have.
It sounds like you're applying that knowledge in what you're doing now.
Yeah, very much so.
Gantt chart.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you're running a real logistics operation here.
Sounds
complex and impressive. You're laughing. It must be quite hard, isn't it?
There's a lot of plates to spin.
Yeah.
But there's a good team there. And I think that's the secret sauce.
There's a good team there.
Yeah. So depends on what you...
What do you look for in your team?
That positive self-starting can-do philosophy. You can train anybody to do most things. I think if they've got the right attitude and the right determination, then you get the right team.
Can do positive self-starting philosophy, regardless of the role. You're looking for that in the people who join you.
Yep.
Because they're people who get stuff done, I guess.
Got anyone?
Right. Well, that's good. That's good advice. We run
you can imagine, Jane and I, we run it lean. We don't have...
You have to, don't you?
Yeah. And everybody that comes, even within senior positions, it's like... We expect you to roll your sleeves up and crack on. Don't expect your team to do it. And we've kind of got this thing. We're like the Pony Express. We have never, ever missed opening a food club ever. And if that means I've got to be on the vans a day, that's fine. We'll do that. And everybody is expected to do that. So we all dig in when needed.
Right. When's your next opening?
Next opening of a hub.
Yeah.
So we are opening, well, I'm focusing on Whitby at the moment. We're opening in the seaside town of Whitby. Yeah. So that should be early September. I mean, we've got a couple of others that we're kind of infilling around our regions at the moment. So in Greater Manchester and places. But
so how do you choose? So you've chosen Whitby as the next one.
Yeah.
Well, what do you look for? How do you do that?
Funding can drive it. So
the local authority.
Yeah, exactly. So if a local authority or a private kind of philanthropist or whatever wants to get involved and do some legacy piece.
How much did it cost to set one up then?
How much you got?
Yeah, good negotiator, but I'm not going to fall for it. Do you not want to say, or is it?
It varies. It varies regionally because it depends on how far away we are from distribution centers, whether we have to do contracts with third-party logistics to actually come to your area, etc.
Yeah.
So I'll give you a ballpark. It's anywhere between 150 and 250.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
So up to a quarter of a million.
Yeah.
But once it's set up, it
runs.
That's
it. It runs.
So if anyone listening wants to set up and support one of these.
Yeah, definitely.
Please do. 150 to 250,000.
I know it sounds a lot.
But but lots of businesses are located in neighborhoods where they could usefully do this, actually.
Absolutely.
I mean, if companies got behind this, that would be great, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. So you also mentioned, Mark, that you work with people who are out of work, unemployed people, or if that's the right way of describing it. And I think you do some work around skills and helping people support people into work, which is something we do as well at Reed. And I'm just interested in what you're doing and how you get on with it.
So quite a lot of people that come to us that are unemployed are quite away from employment, I would say. So we do work with them on things like confidence. And so, for example, today, again, we've got something that's called a living library. So what we've got is a theatre company that has been working with a dozen of our members to give them the confidence to be able to stand up in Westminster today and tell their story.
Wow. So yeah. You're going to stand up in Parliament and tell your story? That's a lot of, quite a big boost.
Exactly.
I think many of us would find that challenging.
We're not standing them on a podium and just saying, listen to me. What we've got is we've got one of the rooms in Westminster and it'll be like a networking event. But
they're going to share their experiences.
Exactly. And it gives them confidence to go and network, introduce themselves. And these are skills that they will need to be able to get to interview, et cetera.
Sure.
So we think that when you look at people that are unemployed, a lot of the time people miss the trick that actually they're so far away from employment that they need a lot of training and development to actually get to that point to be ready to be employed.
So when you say far away from, is that because they've never worked or they have other issues?
So I'll go back to the kind of social supermarket. So we did a pilot, and it was in Barnsley, where we tried to train up 20 people to get jobs. We had a local employer that said, I've got enough jobs to employ all of them. So it was a large employer.
What sort of business?
It was in the food industry.
Right.
So it was a nice link. And so we started with 20, and we went through the process of getting them to interview. And the day of the interview, half of them turned up. And then six of them got offers. And on the day that they should have been starting work, and we were in touch with them all the time.
So you started with 20, 10 got to the interview. Then six got offers.
Two turned up on the first day.
Right.
And one walked out that day.
So you had a 5% success rate.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's quite, so how did you compute that? So what did you do with that? That's quite hard, isn't it?
You got to reflect.
Yeah, so what did you do with that information?
Right? But we learn from failures. Yeah.
So what was the lesson?
This is why we are where we are now, James, with looking at this and looking at those confidence levels first. We went too fast, too soon. Right. These were people that had generational unemployment, didn't even have a clock in the house. Yeah. So don't work to a rhythm. School was what regulated the household.
Mm.
So you have to start understanding that there are basic life admin and skills that sometimes people need support with to help them feel confident with alternative rhythms.
But I mean, some people listening might think, well, these people didn't want a job in the first place, really. You know, they're just idle.
And you're just trying to make me swear.
this is a widely held view.
Yeah.
So say that again.
It's bollocks.
Why?
It's bollocks. I've never met somebody like that.
You've never met someone in all your...
No.
So what's the issue then? Why did you go from 20 to 1?
So I'll give you another example. And
how do we get 20 to 20?
This is why I keep saying it's the confidence. And this is why we invest in these theatre companies and such things so that people can build their skills and confidence, because we think everybody is ready to be employed and they're not.
What's happened to the confidence of people?
I could not explain.
Do you think it's gone down?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, I've wondered that. You're telling me. I mean, you're much closer to this.
Yeah. So why do you say that? One of the drivers that we recruited for our vans, she was brilliant in her community. She was one of the hub leaders that turned up every week and so confident in her community. And I offered her a job, and she took it. And first week she was out, she was great. Second week, she went back home one night and rang me and said, I can't do it anymore. It's just killing me. I'm too stressed.
Right.
And we took her out of a bubble. She was confident in her bubble. And I hadn't thought about it again to say, actually, this is a bigger, wider world with new stakeholders and new rules.
Right.
That we didn't take the time to actually help and support her through.
So would that have been different in the past? Would there have been two people in the van?
No, we've always had just one. But
I'm just thinking years ago.
Yeah.
Deliveries and things.
Yeah.
People work together maybe more. I'm just thinking what would give you know, someone the confidence.
Yeah.
Hey, come along. It's fine. Yeah. You know, I've done this before. Or, you know, there's sort of. Yeah.
And there is a good camaraderie because they, because they're on the van on their own, but only for a short while. Then they're in the hub with the community volunteers who are brilliant and really supportive. Yeah. And back at the warehouse, they've got the rest of the team. Yeah. So there's a, but all of it was outside of their community and their kind of normality, shall we say.
So the this word community, I think may well be very connected to confidence.
Yeah.
You know, if someone feels part of something, then they feel more confident.
I'd agree.
You'd agree with that. And but you said earlier that the sort of view in Westminster is there is no community or some parts of Westminster, and you were very strongly opposed to that suggestion. So there is still a community, but it's not delivering confidence in the way that it used to. Is that so what's going on?
And I suppose that where do people go nowadays, James? Because it used to be church. What brings community together? And that's one of the things that we like, because we bring community together. But what else does nowadays? That's the question, I feel, because there's we need reasons to connect.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because if you went to church, you'd meet people you didn't normally meet or might see in a shop, or and say hello to them, and you feel connected to people you wouldn't normally be connected to.
But what replaces that?
Well, you're not answering that question.
No.
Apart from what you're doing.
Exactly.
And maybe what other organisations.
But when you ask me about where is the kind of confidence in the communities, et cetera, I think it's communities get confidence when they know each other and come together and meet each other so that they're more familiar. So we see it. So an academic that we work with quite often, Dr. Megan Blake up at Sheffield Uni, she will tell you that actually there's statistical evidence to show that when you bring communities together through things like food clubs, even things like policing and crime go down, because actually it's not just about visibility, it's about knowing each other.
Yes.
Yeah, so policing in itself, community policing works effectively because of the visibility, but actually if your community know each other better, then...
So making an effort to get to know each other is your message here, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there need to be... So I for a long time, I was a trustee of Food Cycle, and they do community meals, right? So another great way of bringing people together. Food is always a great connector that way. It's almost like the glue that can always bring us together, whereas I guess religion used to be the thing. But I think food is a good way of doing that nowadays.
Do you have any other ideas about how to rebuild or create community? Well, sports maybe, I don't know.
Sports is a good shout, yeah.
In hobbies and interests, clubs, I don't know.
Yeah.
Youth clubs.
It's who funds them.
Yeah.
I suppose there's a lack of investment in community. So we see quite a lot. But we've seen some really good local authorities that have changed things as well. So...
give me an example.
Hartlepool. Hartlepool approached us to come and open food clubs in their area. Okay. And they were converting some libraries and some council-owned spaces into community hubs. And they wanted bread and butter to go in to attract footfall from the communities. So one of the so the central hub that they had they put stuff in there for there was like a graphic design suite that the teenagers could come in and learn digital skills, or there was a children's library full of nice picture books and craft center. And then there was a kind of occupational health section for the elderly, where they were showing them kind of hoists and kind of the bath where you walk in and fill it up and all this sort of stuff. They really thought about what they were putting in there, as well as a cafe, obviously. But they needed a reason for people to come, and we were going to give them that catalyst to come. And it's just...
So they could come to you and get a bargain.
Yeah, exactly.
And they did they?
They did, yeah.
So that made the rest of it sort of fall into place.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they had the vision to see that was...
Yeah. So
you're in a way, you can be the catalyst to creating a community hub.
Yeah.
But you're only one day a week, though. What happens on the other days?
Well, it doesn't matter, because what you do once you start, once you've engaged and you can see the community coming through the door, then you can talk to them, right? Face to face, when they're there, getting the bags and say, do you know tomorrow's Knit and Natter or toddler group or whatever? You know, the best ones we've seen, they've actually had whiteboards at the door as and on the whiteboard, it's like this week's activities and bang, 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 really simple stuff like that. Yeah. Gets people talking, gets people interested.
Well, there's no reason why every local authority in the country couldn't do that.
Agreed.
And it wouldn't be very high cost because they've all got premises that are underutilized or libraries or whatever. I'm getting behind you here. I think this
You're good.
this is good. I mean, I think because I really feel an absence of community, or I think that's something people really crave. They want that.
Yeah.
And so.
And I would say I don't feel the same, James. So you should come to one of our hubs, and then you wouldn't. You would be inspired.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting. I mean, I suppose I live in central London, and I mean, I've got friends and neighbours, but it's not quite the same as what you're describing.
No.
I mean, there is a local church. I go to it occasionally, but it's not like a regular thing for the whole community.
Yeah. Whereas where we go now, people know the neighbours well.
Right.
And it makes a difference.
Yeah.
For so many reasons, you know, building friendships and just not being as isolated on your own. It's important. You know, social isolation is more dangerous than smoking.
Right.
So, yeah, if you don't go out and you isolate yourself, it's like smoking 20 a day.
Is that what's the evidence for this?
There's good medical evidence for this.
The medical consequences are the same.
There are medical consequences for this.
Right.
So that's
interesting. Well, yeah. So I mean, there are lots of programs to help people stop smoking. Maybe there should be some to help people sort of connect in other ways.
Exactly.
If that's a medical benefit. So what's next for the bread and butter thing and for you yourself, Mark? So
I think the big one for us at the moment, we are trying to convince local authorities and government, he says, rolling his eyes, that food clubs are...
He says, rolling his eyes. What, because this is a difficult process or you find
it's
it frustrating?
It's a difficult, slow process.
So why?
Convincing government that actually the food clubs and community cohesion are...
What are the pushbacks then? People don't need food clubs, community doesn't matter.
No,
I mean,
I don't think they're that.
So what are they?
I don't think that's...
Is it just inertia or what is it?
I think there's way too many things for them to sort out and we're not high enough up the agenda.
I'm interested in creating a movement too. And it's about philanthropy companies. And these are companies that have at least 10% of their shareholding held by a foundation.
Interesting.
Ours is one, curiously. It's got 18% of our shares are held by the Reed Foundation. And I'm interested in it because I want other companies to do the same, because it's enabled us to do a lot philanthropically through our foundation, because the company's paying dividends into it. So if more businesses or all businesses became philanthropy companies or Philcos, and the definition is 10% or more shares in the foundation, they could support all sorts of initiatives like this. And you don't need government at all. And that's because I feel sorry for these politicians in a way. They're always being asked to step up. And I feel sorry for the taxpayer too. But, you know, the businesses could actually do that.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? But David, the guy that's the data analyst that I was telling you about earlier, I asked him about what could government do to help. And he said, well, actually, I think it's beyond governments nowadays. And I think the corporates have got to step up. So I think there's something in that as well.
Well, that's interesting to me. I think very interesting because I'm interested in philanthropy companies or Philcos. And I'm writing a book about this right now that's coming out in the autumn called Karma Capitalism, The Mission to Change the DNA of Business. And the idea is that companies should become philanthropy companies where at least 10% of their shares are held by a charitable foundation. And in that way, you know, the people who work in the company work half a day or more for a charity. And money from the company in terms of dividends paid out can be recycled into community-type endeavours like yours in the areas they operate, or it's other ways that the trustees of their foundation see fit. And this is the model we have at Reed, because 18% of our shares are held by a charitable foundation. So we say, you know, one day a week we work for charity, and the proceeds of the dividends have been used to support Big Give, to raise money for thousands of other charities, and to support organisations like yours who are seeking to do things in communities where people live and work.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's an opportunity to go beyond government and say, let's sort this out ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, companies can become philanthropy companies, communities can come together, and we can do this between us, business and communities. And I think we should really try and do that. So I am urging more people to become philanthropy companies. And you can look that up on philco.org, not UK, because I mean, it's not hard to do. And I think the upsides are huge. They have been for us, both in terms of business, but also in terms of the wider benefits that you can bring to other organizations and people. So there's something beyond government here, I think.
I think there is.
And yours sounds like, I mean, the logistics are obviously complex, but yours sounds quite sustainable, your model, once you've got it going.
Yeah, so we always aspired to be self-funding. A typical startup type scenario in your head financially, you get that seed funding, you get to critical mass, and the kind of day-to-day activities will cover the core costs as well as everything else. And we've had to concede and accept, for now at least, a blended model, because we didn't want to pass on all the cost of living pressures that we're suffering to our members.
No.
So we've looked for the past couple of years at price rises, because we've been impacted with them in many different ways. And we've chosen not to, but to do that as well, we've had to kind of reflect and recognize that means that it's going to further delay when we'll ever become financially sustainable. And it's hard for us, because we're not, we don't see ourselves as a charity. We feel that our members are our customers, and we do the best professional job that we can. And if we do the best we can and give them the best customer service possible, all the social impact that we have is just a natural byproduct. So do the best job you can. Don't focus on the value, because that will come if you do the right thing.
Right. So when you say to become sustainable, so you're relying on other people's funding, or the donations as well as the sales of the food parcels.
Yes.
Yeah. So you want to get to a situation where you're not dependent on that?
Exactly. Or? So we're kind of, so we fund 2/3 of our own overheads. But now we're getting to a point where we need a substantial growth to be able to continue that. So again, accountant talking. So each van is profitable. Do you call yourself profitable when you're a charitable organization?
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
You have to be sustainable.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
And then pre-COVID, each region was profitable. Post-COVID, they're not.
What happened there then?
Cost of living pressures.
Just the prices.
Yeah,
which is what's affecting everyone.
Everyone, yeah. But now we've got to get that back, and it's slowly coming back, where we're getting kind of regional profits again, and we're focusing harder on that. But then how many regions do we need to cover core costs has gone up. Clearly, because actually there's not enough profit in each pocket now to cover the core. So we're pushing out further and further when we will become financially sustainable.
So you need to become larger to become financially sustainable, curious.
Yeah,
that's the model. Yeah. More scale.
Yeah, this is like classic startups, right? Yeah. In anywhere, like an AIM listing or something like that. It's that proof of concept and getting to a point where eventually you have the product that becomes a cash cow and kind of covers all the costs.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. I mean, you said we don't like to think of ourselves as a charity. You're using sort of very obvious business language and techniques here to run the organization. I find that very reassuring, actually. And I think people in business listening would think that too, because I think it might be completely misconceived, but there's a sense that, you know, maybe some charities don't apply those disciplines in their operational activities, but you clearly do, and you've made it a focus.
We have. We don't traditionally recruit out of the third sector either.
Right.
So we look for commercial people and professional people. And I'm not saying that there aren't commercial or professional people within the third sector,
no,
but You're
just not looking for them.
We're not. We're looking for kind of hungry people that are willing to roll their sleeves up and crack on with us and do the best professional job possible. And everybody that comes, they all say, oh, you know, I want to give back and share values and all the rest of it. And we say, that's fine, but you're going to work hard.
Right. Do any of them walk out at that point?
Some do. So our drivers, you know, I've spent many a year having the final interview with our drivers and saying to them, I know it looks great. I know you've done a trial day. I know that the sun was shining, but when it's 3 degrees and horizontal rain, you've still got to do this. And when you wake up at 6 a.m. and you can see that it's snowing or the M60 is shut, you've still got to come in and you've still got to do the do, and it's hard and you'll be knackered and cold and uncomfortable. Please think about that before you come to us. And some of the guys talk about it as boot camp. The first 6 weeks, they say it's like boot camp.
It almost reminded me of Shackleton's job ad, you know, going to the South Pole when you were describing that.
it's management.
You've got lots of people queuing
but
up.
But again, it's management of expectations, right? It's just like you've got to have the right people coming through.
What I'm hearing when you say that is not all the difficulties or adversities you might have driving around the M60. I'm hearing this is important, what we're doing, and we need to deliver for our members because it matters.
Yeah.
And I think that's very motivational, actually. Yeah, yeah. And that would make me want to sign up. So you're looking for people, I suppose, who are engaged in that mission.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's wonderful what you're doing, and I'd like to commend people to support you if we can in all sorts of ways. Because it sounds like there are a number, whether it's getting involved in the community or whether it's supporting you financially or as a local authority, opening a new hub.
It's becoming a thing, James.
Yeah, it's becoming a thing. And I wish you continued success with the thing.
Thank you.
And I'd like to invite you back in the future to see how it's progressed.
I'd be happy to come back.
Thank you for coming in to talk to me today, Mark. I found that fascinating. Now, I've got a couple of questions for you that I always ask at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Jane might have tipped you off.
No. I've listened to you, James. I know what's coming.
Oh, you know what's coming. The first question I like to ask at the end is related to the poster on the wall, and it's an important theme for me, is what gets you up on a Monday morning, Mark?
So I've listened to your podcast, and I've listened to some of the answers, and I've tried to think about this long and hard, because one of the things that, so you asked me earlier about why did Jane and I start this, and it's fairness. It's inequalities that people can face for no fault of their own, even in the UK, right? And that frustration that it's wrong and I feel like we can do something about it, that drives me to get up on a Monday morning.
So you...
It's almost like an agitation in my head.
Yeah, people don't like unfairness.
No.
But you're feeling it really sort of strongly, and that gets you up.
Very much
so. To go and do something about it.
Yeah.
All right. I can see that in your eyes. And I believe you absolutely. And then the next question is from my interview book, Why You, 101 Interview Questions You'll Never Fear Again. And it's one of the fateful 15, as it's called, is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time, Mark?
So I did think about this as well. One of the things that we do, obviously, that isn't community-based is the food redistribution piece. And I think the food redistribution sector needs fixing somehow. It's not fractured, but there's no kind of... It's not seen as a market sector. It's not seen as having any regulatory bodies or anything like this. And I think that needs fixing somehow, because as much as we do all this great work and we rescue all this food from going to waste, et cetera, everything's done on a handshake.
Hmm.
And that's not sustainable. And the redistribution sector itself needs to be able to have service contracts and tender processes and fair codes of practice. And it all sounds really dull, but actually this is about maturing a sector and having it recognized. And I think I want to go into that space because...
Well, you'd like to lead that endeavor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I see I'm going.
Well, that sounds wonderful. I wish you every success with that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming to talk to me.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Mark, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reed, Mark Game, the bread and butter thing, all links are in the show notes. See you next time.